Victor Matander of the county.
804, 805, 805, section 805, to have these bodies in existence as part of the requirement, the way that the state meets the subsistence provisions of ANILCA, to be in compliance with ANILCA. And the advisory committees are composed of individuals and local communities. The regional councils are composed of the chairman of local advisory committees. The state sees both those bodies as the one fundamental way to get proposals for regulatory change to accommodate subsistence uses into the before the boards of fisheries and board of game. On your second question about federal funding, ANILCA also specified that if the state met these provisions, the state would be reimbursed up to $5 million a year for its activities related to support for the advisory committee and regional council system, and also for technical support to the advisory committees and regional councils. And the way that the state has provided those has been through the board, the division of boards within the Department of Fish and Game, which provides staff and also travel funds for the advisory committees and regional councils. Also, a portion of those funds go to the Division of Subsistence for the research that it conducts and for the staff that it provides. Those staff are available to the advisory committees and regional councils to assist them in developing proposals. The state, although ANILCA says up to $5 million are to be available, Congress has never appropriated more than $1 million. And that's a reimbursable amount. The state has to spend $2 million to get $1 million. We're currently spending about $4 million on this in this area between the boards and the Division of Subsistence, and the state does get reimbursed $1 million. Your third question, I'm not familiar with the regulations for deer hunting and salmon, silver salmon in Southeastern, but my understanding is that the deer regulations, maybe I better just leave it at that, but my typically in those kinds of situations, unless the board of game tries to accommodate customer traditional uses through its normal seasons and bag limits. And in Southeastern, my understanding is in many areas the deer seasons and bag limits are fairly liberal. There's fairly long seasons in some areas, but that's quite variable. I'm not familiar with the silver salmon situation. I could certainly get that information for you.
Steve?
I just want to make a couple of comments about the situation because they point up some of the dilemmas in the currently operating subsistence law. I don't think we want to go into them at great length right now. This is a community, a heterogeneous community with a population of, Nelson mentioned, 2,000.
Akachak. We were able-bodied young men at that time, and Takpak would occasionally admonish us to go ashore and get something to eat. This was during the time that all we had in our whaling camp were weaponry. We were given a small cup of tea infrequently. Yes, those were the hard times we experienced when whaling. Finally, the time came when Akivak took us out to hunt for seals. Since we did not have even have scraps of food to eat. Along the way, we met the Akuchuk hunters. They encouraged us to go ashore to get something to eat. So we did eat till we were full. Afterwards, we headed back out to hunt for seals. We did finally find one seal, but missed it, which was to be our only source of food. Thus, we traveled hunting for seals, came onto a land, fast ice, and were lucky to catch a seal, at which time the land, fast ice, began flowing away at a rapid pace. We were not worried because we had secured our seal, but we also saw other hunters who had to run for safety, so they began discarding their game they had caught. We began retrieving them so we would have more to eat. We were fortunate to retrieve those games. At that time, we were not able to hunt for whales because we were late in whale hunting. But at least we had secured game, thus enabling us to survive a little longer. I do not have much more to say at this point. I hope that I have helped out in what I had to say. That was Alfred Leavitt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please give Mr. Leavitt our thanks, too.
Justice Berger and colleagues, friends, I think you can understand from what he read to you about how the whaling captains view their whaling activities. It is not just for them. And if you can imagine what happened, what reaction came about in 1977 when they were asked to stop whaling, it was incomprehensible. And people were deeply hurt. And then we started, the people gathered together in 77 to deal with it in Barrow from the nine villages who are presently in the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. And that was the time when the Whaling Commission was formed to deal with the ban on bowhead hunting. I remember listening to the meeting. I was out working for a camp where we were teaching kids how to hunt, teaching them about the plants, teaching them. Scientists were saying in the beginning when we started dealing with the scientists, we were basically battling each other. And then once we came to an agreement, we started working on a coordination process between the AEWC and the North Slope Borough and the federal government and the state government to coordinate what projects were being done and to get away from duplicating different scientific research. So we have been involved with that process. And before they go up to the villages, they ask for the permission of the whaling captains to go out there because they can be disruptive to some activities out there. So they do go to the whaling villages and ask for them to, you know, ask them to support them, and they do, realizing what it is for.
That's interesting. There seems to be a fair parallel here, probably not a planned one, but the end result is the same. We have a scientific licensing system that any research conducted in the field is done through a scientific permit. Before that permit is issued, it is obligatory that there's consultation with the local Hunters and Trappers Association, and in some cases we require their involvement.
I have a couple of questions that I might, if I may, I'd like to put before noon, and then in the afternoon we can start off with the International Porcupine Caribou Commission and hear from Jonathan Solomons and his group, and from the CYI and others. According to Steve's paper, you said this, Marie, that the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission was established in 1977, and it was established by whaling captains from each of the nine villages coming together and constituting themselves the commission and saying, okay, we've got to do something about this. And you went ahead and did it. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to do. But did anybody say to you, well, where is your legal mandate? Where's the state law that says you can talk to us? Where's the federal law? Show us your credentials. Give us a piece of paper. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I guess it's just part of self-determination that we consider ourselves United States citizens, and we have as much right as anybody else to say how we feel to the government and take some initiative. That's, you know, I think that we didn't even consider that. I mean, I don't think people even thought or asked themselves that question.
Well, I didn't think so, but Tony Vasca.
Thank you. I suspect that it's probably easy to generalize and say that I think most of us who have had to deal with a variety of management agencies have had to own up to credentials, and Marie is correct in saying that, yes, there is a forum to allow us to come and tell people, managing agents or agencies, what it is exactly that we want. And in observing the different forums that operate, whether it's the migratory caribou or the whales or the birds, the public process that is allowed by the federal or state governments allows for people to get together. That exists now.
Tell us what has been the response of the state and the federal government to date to the specifics in the commission plan which you guys laid out at that time?
Yes, the state of Alaska, I said, is cooperating finally with the Caribou Commission. We make up the task force for it, and we worked out the wording. Now it went to public hearing, and now they're going to meet with the fish and wildlife people. But we never approached the federal yet. It's not. After we get all these things out of the way, then we go to federal.
Yeah, Woodrow.
When you filed your Caribou Commission with the United Nations, did you file it as a commission, or were you seeking NGO or non-governmental organization status?
No, we filed as commission under the Indigenous People Rights.
So then, on these international dealings, do you deal directly with the Canadians, or who does the commission deal directly with?
With our brothers on the other side, because we are a sovereign nation. We can deal with other countries.
So then the commission is set up then to affect United States policies and Canadian policies for the management of the herds? Is that what it's for?
Pardon me?
That the commission was established to affect, or would we say develop policies for management of the porcupine caribou herd. Are you trying to get those policies adopted by both the United States and Canadian governments, or?
Are you asking that does a treaty manage the herd?
Yeah, who's going to manage the herd then?
We do not propose the commissioner to manage the herd. We don't propose that. We propose that the Yukon government and the state of Alaska manager, we're looking for protection of the habitat, as you see it up there, the range of the porcupine caribou herd. We only, the commissioners of the international treaty will only become, if you call it such, manager of this treaty, only in emergency cases if the herd started to decline. Until that time, both countries will manage through its State Department or through its federal, territorial government. We recognize that the state of Alaska Fish and Game will manage on this site. All we worry about is the quota, how much should be taken every year from this herd, how that's divided between two countries. That's their prerogative to make that decision.
Tony Vasca.
Thank you. Jonathan, how does the state of Alaska, through the Department of Fish and Game, deal with the sovereign government of the Kuchin? I mean, you're saying that you're dealing with the International Porcupine Commission as a sovereign government. How does the state of Alaska, through the Department of Fish and Game, represent your interests as Alaskan citizens, or how do they deal with your government?
We deal directly. I don't know how else to answer that.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I might direct the question to Larry Spengler.
Yeah. Larry Spengler.
Tony, I guess I don't quite understand the question.
I don't either.
The question is, the sovereign government of Vinitai, Fort Yukon, Mr. Solomon mentioned several other villages. Basically, you're dealing with a tribal government, an IRA government that was formed some years ago, and they are the principals in the negotiations with the Canadians using the International Porcupine Commission, which is recognized by the United Nations. How does the state of Alaska deal with that?
In developing the state's position on the international porcupine caribou matter, the state consulted very directly in a series of meetings with the International Porcupine Commission, with Jonathan Solomon's groups and so forth, and then also opened the whole matter up for wider public comment and had one or two meetings at which other people could come and express their views. And all of those were taken to the governor's office, and final decisions were made on what the state's position would be.
Snowmobiles over routes that just make sense, because that's the way you get there. Parks Canada has no idea at the moment of placing any restrictions on that.
Thank you. Rosita, and then Marie, and then Hugh.
I have two questions for Victor. Victor, you mentioned that in your In Canada agreement that you are going to recommend maintaining a list of native users. Could you expand on that?
Well, basically, what we say is that the people that rely on that herd should be based on tradition, use, and occupancy, and present use. Right now, with laws that we have in Canada, a lot of status Indians can hunt freely throughout, eh? And what we're saying here is that in terms of conservation and maintaining the present levels, there are people that use the herd right now, and those people that use that herd should have the right to use that herd in the future. What we have to do is come forward with a list from those communities, those eight communities, who those people are that harvest the herd. To regulate in a lot of communities that border the the range itself, there are a number of people that live in the community that don't harvest the herd itself. And what we want to do is to restrict access to those people and to ensure that the people that use the herd right now would have the right to use it in the future. And by doing that, we have to develop a list as to who those people are.
And their offsprings, or?
That's right. It's traditional use and occupancy, and they're, what we say, we've got a section in the agreement that speaks to those people and their offsprings or their future generations that would follow would have the right to access to that herd.
The second question that I have, you really didn't discuss your what you saw or envisioned to be in that international agreement, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts or what did you see in relationship to commenting on oil exploration and development in the Arctic National Wildlife Range and also on Vinatai, the Vinatai Reservation?
Well, that area there, as I understand it, is, in our view, very sensitive because of the calving grounds and the staging grounds for the caribou before they migrate, they gather in that area. What we see is that those areas should be held off from any kind of development at all. For instance, in the North Yukon, we take the position that, first of all, that a park be established in North Yukon, we've got that. That also there be a land use planning regime set up for the North Yukon where oil exploration or resource development or hydrocarbon developments up there would be subject to an environmental screening process. First of all, whether it's in the national interest, whether it's in the interest of that area, and what the environmental and socioeconomic impacts are that would result from that, and secondly, what measures or mitigative measures.
It is seen as an inherited right. It's seen as an inherited right that applies to the entire collective of people who are eligible for the settlement. It does not depend upon the lifestyle of those people. It wouldn't depend on the technology of their harvest. It wouldn't depend upon where they live within the claim area. It wouldn't depend upon whether they exercise that right often or infrequently. It would be seen as a birthright. Another respect in which I think it helps to think of it as a property right, and I've referred to this in my general comments, is that the holders of these rights would have considerable discretion in how they use them, in other words, how they use the harvest. And I think the main importance of having that kind of discretion from the point of view of the Dene Métis is to protect the subsistence priority, which is their priority. But it also would provide them with the option to use the resource for other purposes, including what some people might even call sport, but primarily commercial purposes. And in our discussions, we are talking about exclusive rights to commercial licenses in some respects, and with respect to other kind of economic uses of wildlife, rights of first refusal. We're talking about preferential opportunities to farm, to ranch, to retail, to manufacture.
Sorry, to farm?
Fur farming.
Fur farming.
Yeah.
And what's ranching?
Ranching perhaps of buffalo. There is a reindeer preserve mostly outside of mostly inside the Inuvialuit settlement area. But that kind of thing as a potential future use that if and when it appears to be feasible and if and when the Dene Métis consider that it accords with their own values and that they can organize themselves socially
in such a way that that makes sense to them, that that they will have a preferential opportunity to go into that kind of thing. Another respect in which one might consider this a property right is that the Dene Métis, although they haven't developed a detailed position on the question and haven't begun to negotiate it, plan to negotiate a right to compensation for loss of harvesting opportunities, a right which would provide them possibly with substitute resources, possibly new access, and possibly restriction on competitive uses to other areas if a particular area that they depend upon is damaged, and from their point of view would provide some deterrence to industry and government to in their activities on land that that may conflict with subsistence harvesting. And lastly, I think it might help to characterize this as a property right in the sense that the Dene Métis are considering what kind of judicial remedies they might